Hey, welcome back, friends. Thanks for joining us again as we continue our way through Genesis. Today, moving into really what we consider the second of two creation accounts. The second one in some ways nests inside the first one. The second one, as we move through this, you will notice, I think right away, that it's a much different flavored story. For one thing, the language is different. We've been consistently using the word God. We're now going to move really to the word Lord, Lord God at some points. This is a difference in the way that the terminology about God is used. Also, this story is different. It's less layered. It's less organized. It's a kind of earthier, not I don't want to say messier, but it's a more condensed story, and it jumps to the main points far quicker without some of the trapping. So we'll get a couple of verses in here, and then we can talk about some of this. In the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, when no plants of the field were yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no one to till the ground. So in the first story, we have God moving over the face of the deep, of chaos, of creation. Here we have kind of, again, that condensed, the earth seems to be made, but there's no plants yet. There's no herbs, so there's also no rain. So if you're going to try, and as people have done, try to locate this story within the other story, I don't know, you're somewhere day two, day three, but this story simply isn't told like that. The Lord has not caused rain, and there's no one to till the ground. So this presumes the role of someone who is going to come and partner in, or at least work in, the creation alongside God. The earth needs not only the finished work of God, but the as of yet undone work of someone who will come later. And this sets the stage in a very different way. I don't think you have to read further than this one verse to realize we're coming from a very different perspective than in the first story.
Yeah, let's remember our context. We ended with chapter 2, verse 4 yesterday with this idea that the generations of the heavens and earth were created. Now it says, in the day that the Lord God made. I think what's interesting here is that immediate transition phrase, in the day, because our previous creation story focused on that day structure. It had that beautiful kind of rhythmic liturgical order to the days. We need that transition to get us into this story. To your point, and I'm just rewording what you just said, Clint, we now are finding a very different kind of rubric of understanding the creation. Instead of seeing it as this ordered, intentional day-by-day process, we're now going to see it from the lens of God's intention, of God's even relationship that was built into the creation. It is not contradictory. If it would have been, the writers would have glossed it differently. They would have not put them side by side. It's clear that these are intended to go together, this bridge of these simple words. In the day that the Lord made, this is supposed to point out that these stories are connected. Yet, as we change perspective and frame, we're going to get to see it from a different vantage. And I think what we find in this story is that God's intentionality was more than just creating order. It intended a kind of a created relationship and a created partnership even that we're going to see fleshed out. It is because of this story that intensifies the story that came before it that we begin to see the setup for what we're going to have happen in chapter 3, which, of course, we'll get to. But I just want to point out how beautifully connected these are, despite the fact, to your point, it's very clear that we're seeing it from different lenses.
Right. Because of the way that day is used in the first story, I don't want to argue translation here, but I think a more helpful way to think about this introduction would be at the time, rather than in the day, at the time the Lord God made, because this story is using the word day very differently than the first story. In the first story, that is an ordered measure of a specific time period on which in which something happens. Here, it's a much looser reference. It's just when God made things, this is what happened. It's not as structured. It's not as logistical. It's simply when God did it, this is what happened in the midst of that. And so a very different. So verse 6 here, but a stream would rise from the earth and water the whole face of the ground. Then verse 7, we get into kind of the meat of the story. Notice how quickly we go from God's work in creation generally to the specific of the creation of humans. This story wants to go there immediately. We took almost an entire chapter to get there in the first chapter. Now we go right there in two verses in this one. So verse 7, then the Lord God formed, and the word here is sort of fashioned like pottery almost. The Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Now, again, what a different way of telling the story. In the first story, you'll remember God spoke and things came into existence. Here, God actually works in the parameters of creation. He gets down in the dirt and he builds a man, the shell of a man, and then puts breath. And remember that in both Hebrew and Greek, the word breath is also the word spirit and the word wind. And so this idea of breath is not just physical breath, not just lungs, but of spirit. He animated the man. He gave the wind of life. He put breath in the man. He kneels down. He builds the man. And at the breath of God, at the giving of breath, the man becomes a living being.
So I want to just point out a couple things here. Notice that this story shares the kind of emphasis that the previous story had. Even though, like Clint said, it's a much abbreviated version of the natural processes, we still have water coming up, a recognition of how important water is to sustaining our life as we know it. Also, this idea that God is making life possible on the entire planet. So this idea of God's creative sustenance. And then what I think is so fascinating is this language for the dust of the ground that we had in verse 7. This comes from that Hebrew word adamah, or what we later are going to see as Adam, the idea of dust, dirt, earth. This idea that we have even in our worshiping life today, if you come on an Ash Wednesday, that connection to from dust we came, to dust we'll return, from earth we came, to earth we return, that God takes the building blocks of creation, that which is, and God makes out of that something that is even able to bear the life of God. That's what we later see from the Christian interpretation of God taking on life in Jesus Christ. This idea that God even took on the very human earth and flesh that we as humans were created in. So that's reading from the New Testament backwards. The point here being made by the author, though, is that we are deeply connected to this original earth, that God takes of the stuff that's here, and God then fashions that into a thing, and then by God's breath, life, spirit, spiritual ability, God makes life appear in that thing. And I think the image that helps me here, Clint, is if you've ever had a child who is, you know, walking along and they accidentally step on an ant, you know, and they're distraught because the ant doesn't keep going. They don't yet understand that idea of death. That there's this idea that we have that when there's breath in a thing, it has a kind of mysterious vitality and life. But when that breath leaves that thing, then it no longer is. And that's both a physical reality, but we also have a spiritual overtone to this, that God instills within the human a ability. Well, we'll see that teased out later, but I think that's a beautiful vantage here in this text.
Yeah, and clearly, you know, we have in that first story this idea of the image of God. Here, the idea of the breath of God sort of carries that weight. It is literally the Spirit of God that animates humans, that makes them come to life, that makes the transition. This shell is ready to live, but until the breath of God enters it, it is not a living thing. And that is the story's way of saying that life depends on the movement of God's Spirit, particularly human life here, though one could argue maybe all life in general. And now we move to verse 8. The Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So again, unlike the first story, or in contrast to the first story where we have a kind of global or even universal story, this story shrinks its setting to a particular place, to a garden here in Eden, or near Eden. That the idea that we're going to confine this story to a specific place within the whole of creation where God plants a garden and puts the man in it. And in the garden, we're not told about the whole of creation, but in the garden, there are plants that are good for food. They're pleasant for the eye. Again, that sense of it is good here. It's very good. And the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which are going to come into the story later. But you can kind of tell this story is much more agrarian. God is in the dirt. Man is made of dirt. God is planting things. Things are being watered. The first things that come to sight after the man, unlike the other story where the man is last, here we have essentially the man being created first, and then there are plants. So the man has access to all this within the garden, and it's a very different story in that it's far more contained than our first version.
Yeah, and it has in mind setting up a kind of spiritual theme that the other took in a very different direction. Let me explain it this way. The first one we saw towards the end of the creation story at the very beginning of chapter 2, the end of chapter 1 there. We saw the lesson being that because God made, and because God's greatness is so vast that God rests on that seventh day, that we have instituted this liturgical daily kind of schedule as part of our human experience of the world, that to be faithful and to follow in the way of the Creator is to live in this hallowed day, right? We're only a couple sentences into our English translation of this second story, and we already have not only God making this life, but God setting up this tree that we know is going to play such a prominent role, or the idea that God is making this lush garden. Eden means in Hebrew delight. It's this verdant, beautiful, idyllic kind of place, and yet we are already seeing the beginning of foreshadowing of the kinds of difficult choices that are going to lie ahead in the story. There's a kind of very specific telling of what is a cosmic story. It's specific, and that's a specific garden, specific creation that God's working on. And yet we can already begin to get this sense that what God is doing here is already setting the stage for a much more cosmic story of all humanity. It's setting up this thing that is vast in its particularity. Does that make sense? I may be saying that in a difficult way.
Well, one way that might be helpful to get there is that scholars, as they think about these two stories and the way in which they interact with one another. This second story is often thought to be older. It has a more mythic kind of feel to it. It's more comparable to some of the ancient stories. And it makes sense that this looser story was told first, and then someone came in and kind of provided more structure, provided more detail in the specifics. And so as we read this first story, we're going to, I'm sorry, this older story, the second story in the Bible, we're, I think, going to see the ways in which this story mashes things together. So you have creation, you have Garden of Eden, you have Tree of Life, Tree of Good and Evil, you have loneliness, you have temptation, you have command, you have disobedience. All of these things get wrapped up together in a way that's not as clean as the first story is. The first story is very segmented, very regimented. This story is more like putting all those things in a bag and shaking them up. And it's the way that it's told that helps deliver us ultimately to the story. So the next piece, we won't really spend much time with this. In fact, we'll probably skip it tomorrow. But I do want to tell you verses 10 through 14 are a kind of a stage, a location thing. There are rivers involved. And in the ancient world, they located this garden in that general region. And this helped them draw the map of it. But for our purposes, I don't think there's much at stake in these verses. You can sure read them, but I don't think they do a lot for us. So we will probably pick up tomorrow with verse 15.
I'm curious, Clint, check me on this. In the first creation story, would you say, is there ever a setup for the idea of the moral order of the universe? I mean, here we have right away this idea, God creates the human, we have the garden, then we have this thing, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Is there an analog to that, would you say, in the first creation story?
No, I think in the first story, we see not a lot of interaction between God and the created order, other than the call to be fruitful, to multiply. There's really no inherent struggle. I think that story is told with a single purpose, to talk about creation. I think this story, creation, is the opening purpose, but it quickly moves to other themes. And in that, I think we see a major difference between the first and second story. I think the first story is far more contained, and the second is a multi-point sermon, really. It's not just an account. Yeah. It is a lesson, and there are multiple themes in it. I think tomorrow and Monday, by the end of Monday or Tuesday next week, I hope that will be a very clear case.
All right. Sounds good. Well, friends, thanks for being with us today. We will see you tomorrow.
Thanks, guys.